I am tonight surrounded by religious scholars, or rather scholars of religion, though they may vary in the degree of religiosity, as we will shortly observe. They are Bishop Richard Holloway, one should say Bishop Emeritus, of the Episcopal Church in Edinburgh, Scotland, who is the author of many books. The newest is titled Doubts and Loves, What is Left of Christianity. We will find that perhaps not as much is left as lots of Christians think. Robert Funk is with us once again. He's been here before. He is the founder of the well-known Jesus Seminar and director of the West Star Institute in California. And we are joined as well by Mark Talbot, who's been here once before, professor of philosophy at Wheaton College and a member of the Council of Confessing Evangelicals, and John E. Phelan, Jr., who is president and dean of North Park Theological Seminary and is ordained in the denomination of the Evangelical Covenant Church, that being one of the main descendants from Swedish Pietism. Gentlemen, if you will allow me, if only in the mode of a pseudo-scholar, to give you a few paragraphs by way of epigraphic introduction. The first few come from the Book of John, you all will recognize all of these quotations. The next day John seeth Jesus coming unto him and saith, Behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. That's Agnus Dei qui tollis peccata mundi, as I remember it. And continuing in John, For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And Jesus saith unto him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. All of those different verses from the Book of John. But now I offer you Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche in one outburst, who says, I call Christianity the one great curse, the one enormous and innermost perversion, the one great instinct of revenge for which no means are too venomous, too underhand, too underground, and too petty. I call it the one immortal blemish of mankind. Which one was right, Robert Funk?
Do I have to choose between those two extremes?
Or find a middle position if you've got one?
Well, I know you know, the Gospel of John has provided us with a good deal of the mythological frame of reference for Orthodox Christianity. But in some ways, I prefer Nietzsche, I guess, who was more of a skeptic and thought that a good deal of the Christian tradition had been created by human means. And
But he hated and fulminated against Christianity.
Well, that's true.
Surely you don't hate Christianity.
No, of course not. I think there are many great things about this tradition that's worth preserving and translating into forms that we can use in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mark Talbot, I'm not, as you know, a Christian. We are old acquaintances, and I've enjoyed our pleasant acquaintanceship over the years, but you know that I'm a Jew and sort of a secularized Jew, though with some persisting God hunger, as I think any intelligent man would have. That being the case, should I take John seriously? Should I myself take John and those verses seriously? They tell me, in essence, that Jesus was the Son of God, and he came to redeem mankind and to save me from my otherwise sinful nature.
I think that John meant you to take them seriously. John thought that, in fact, Jesus was the Messiah, and therefore was the person for whom the Jewish nation had been waiting.
And but so do you agree with John?
I do.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume, though I could be mistaken, I'll find out in an instant, that John Phelan also agrees with John.
Yes, I do. I would agree with John as well.
Then why does not the Episcopal Bishop of Edinburgh agree? Because I've been reading your book, and you seem to have developed away from a commitment to Orthodox Christianity.
Yes, because I think that religion is a changing thing. And it evolves, it changes. There have been many different ways of being Christian. I think the Gospel of John is a very good example of that. It clearly came at the time when Christianity was itself breaking away from your church, Judaism. And I think that accounts for the stridency in John, the kind of incipient anti-Semitism that's in there. I think the thing has gone on growing and changing. I have gone on growing and changing. I don't think John is history. I think it's kind of theological meditation on what he, by that time, thought Jesus was. I don't think that that's what Jesus was.
I read in an article about you in The Guardian, that was sent along by the publicity people who are promoting your very interesting new book, Doubts and Loves, What is Left of Christianity. Those publishers, by the way, are, well, who are they?
Canongate. Canongate's an old bit of Edinburgh. It's a bit of the Royal Mile, and that's an Edinburgh publisher.
Oh, I see. Great. But I did read that your first book, this being your 24th, was railed against all that you now invoke as the truth.
That's right. I've become in my 60s the kind of bishop I hated in my 30s. But Shakespeare said the whirligig of time brings in its revenges, so it just shows you, be careful of your enemies because you might turn into it.
Well, what in fact is the state of Anglicanism in England and in Scotland, and for that matter, the Episcopal Church in this country? I get a sense that there are lots of Anglican or Episcopal priests who are not by any means fully persuaded that their faith is worth lifelong investment.
I think it's in a state of tumult, but I think religion is, because it's intrinsically about unknowable mysteries, and that's why we get so hostile and worked up with one another. Mathematicians don't get as worked up about their subject as theologians get worked up about theirs, and I think that Anglicanism is a particular bit on the continuum of religious controversy. We've always been fairly open and allowed a wide latitude of approach to the basic Christian tradition, from conservative evangelicals right over to radicals like Don Cupid and myself, whom other people think are barely left within Christianity. And I'm in that book asking whether I am still legitimately capable of calling myself a Christian, holding the faith in the way that I now do. But that's characteristic of Anglicanism, to do things in that way.
Well, you say that Anglicanism is in ferment. I would agree from my far more minimal observation. But in wandering around the academic circuits, I've run into a fair number of intellectual evangelicals and fundamentalists, and on the social circuit one encounters them occasionally. And I do not get a sense, though I'm not a member of any of those churches, that you find a similar ferment at that end of Christianity.
I think that there's a ferment, but of a different sort. It seems to me that within the more conservative classical Christianity circles, there is a great deal of intellectual vigor right now. For instance, the Society of Christian Philosophers comprises a fair segment of the whole American philosophical community, and so it's quite possible to defend a conservative faith in a vigorous way that doesn't walk away from the integrity of the documents.
Well, I would say that you said intellectual fundamentalist, and that's almost an oxymoron, I would think. But there is a considerable amount of ferment among evangelicals. At the latest meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society out in Denver, there was an attempt to oust a group of evangelical scholars who have what's called a more open view of God. In other words, a sense that God is not the sort of rigorous controlling figure that is known in the more conservative form of Calvinism. So the notion that evangelicalism is some sort of a monolithic huge reality with everybody thinks the same is quite mistaken.
I'm interested in a potential distinction that you just made between evangelical and fundamentalist. You were saying a moment ago that intellectual fundamentalist may be an oxymoron, or in honor of Bishop Holloway, we might call it an oxymoron. That's the way they say it over there.
No, I'm an oxymoron guy.
What is the evangelical view of fundamentalism then?
Well, there would be a lot of people that would say an evangelical is a fundamentalist who went to school, and that's a little bit unfair. But I would think fundamentalism is as much a social reality as it is an intellectual and spiritual reality. Mm-hmm. And obviously, evangelicals and fundamentalists have a lot in common, but there's an awful lot of difference between the two of us as well.
You're suggesting the difference is in level of theological sophistication.
Well, no,
in part, but not entirely.
I wouldn't say that that's exactly it. Generally, it's explained in terms of the historical development that the fundamentalists were taking a position in the 20s and 30s in the United States, the evangelicals, and wanting to become part more of American life in general, gave themselves that name after the Second World War, particularly through Billy Graham and so on. I wouldn't want to say for a moment that evangelicalism is anything monolithic, but I would want to claim that there is a very strong movement toward classical Christianity within what was evangelicalism. I'm not sure that that's a good term anymore for it, where there's a great deal of vigorous intellectual thinking going on now.
You would all agree that classical or more or less orthodox Christianity of whatever variety bases itself upon the truth that is revealed and given in the New Testament. It is the work of the Jesus Seminar to closely re-examine the New Testament, and particularly the characterization of and the sayings of Jesus, and ask what is authentic and what is not. Robert Funk has been engaged in that work for a long time. After we return from some commercials, which are imminent, there's a good religious word, imminence hounds us. After those commercials, I want to turn to Robert Funk and ask him to explain what the Jesus Seminar has been up to and how their work does, or in his view, or in your view, may not illuminate the continuing issues in Christian worship and belief itself. We return directly to our panel of four distinguished guests, going first directly to Robert Funk after we pause for these words. And directly back to Mark Talbot, John Phelan, Richard Holloway, and Robert Funk. And to Robert Funk, the founder of the Jesus Seminar. What's the intention? What was the intention? How was the Jesus Seminar supposed to illuminate the ambiguities in our religious life?
Well, we set out to finish the task that was begun about 200 years ago, which was to disengage the historical figure of Jesus of Nazareth from the creedal framework that had been provided for him by the church, formulated largely in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, and it's lasted all this time. But finally, it seemed to many of us that it had begun to erode and crumble. So I found a number of my colleagues in the New Testament field who had come to certain conclusions that were unorthodox in relation to the scholarly tradition, but they had not said anything about those in public, had not written about them. So we came together and began to share our views and discovered that we had a good many things in common.
I think I may have told you this once. There was a memorable night on this program quite a number of years ago, 15 or 18 years ago, when Hans Kung, the Catholic theologian, was the guest, the sole guest. And he's a very intense fellow. And he said that his work was to discover who the real man Jesus was and what that means for his religion. And as he got more and more excited, he lapsed, almost not knowing he was doing it, into German and said, "Aber wer war diesem Jesu?" But who was he, this Jesus? I repeat that to you. Wer war diesem Jesu?
Well, it's difficult to say because we have only a few memory traces, I think, in all of the Gospels that have survived from antiquity. In addition to the four that we have in the New Testament, there is an additional 18 Gospels and Gospel fragments mostly. And we have decided as historians that we should look at all of them carefully. We didn't learn a lot from the other Gospels, with the one exception perhaps of Thomas, that has served as a good control for...
These are non-canonical Gospels.
These are non-canonical Gospels, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what have you learned, really? Finally, let me put it another way. Why not just take the Bible, as the fundamentalists say we should, as the literal Word of God and as the literal truth, and thus an absolutely accurate account of what happened there in Palestine over 2,000 years, well, a little bit less than 2,000 years ago?
Yeah. Well, because historical critical scholarship has been with us for a couple of hundred years or more, rose out of the Enlightenment. Most of us are trained in that tradition and learn to distinguish fictions from history. And so we've been about that work steadily over the years. So the seminar is nothing more or less than a continuation of that kind of program.
John Phelan, when you read the New Testament, and particularly the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, can you take them as sort of literally true?
Well, you have to look at the Gospels as the church's book. And the problem with the kind of historical analysis that Dr. Funk is talking about is that when you're done, you really don't have much left. You really can't construct a figure. You can't construct a person out of the fragments that are left. And I, as a person of the church, as a person of faith, do take the text very seriously and take the person they reveal in the text very seriously. And I don't think that's necessarily a contradiction to historical scholarship. I think what historical scholarship and rationalist tradition can reveal and tell us about Jesus is very, very minimal.
Surely you do take very seriously, you would have to, the assertion that after his crucifixion he was put away in the cave and on the third day he rose.
Oh, yes.
The reincarnation is something in which you would put absolute... rather the resurrection, that I said. I shouldn't have said reincarnation. You would put absolute faith in the resurrection.
Yeah, I believe in the resurrection. I believe in the incarnation of Christ. I think those are central theological assertions of Christianity.
Bishop Holloway, what do you do with those same assertions?
I now treat them as metaphor because I no longer can accept the basic worldview in which they're embedded. I can't buy a three-decker universe. If Jesus has left the tomb, I mean, where is he? Where's his body? In a quantum universe, there's no up, there's no down. Is he debris in outer space? I can't myself. I don't object, obviously, to people who can make sense of it. I can't make sense of it historically myself. I see resurrection as a metaphor for the ongoing possibility of human transformation and the need to transform in our ugly and distorted world. So I see it as a precipitate towards action for me, not as a piece of kind of mental furniture that I install in my
head. In fact, in your new book, you make clear that your general approach to the Bible, New Testament, and I would assume Old Testament as well, is that these are not trustworthy narratives. They are rather poetic approximations, and as such, they have meaning if one knows how to discover the meaning.
Well, I think they are trustworthy within that particular genre, and I think it's a misreading to try and read them as history. I mean, can you read Genesis 1 as history? Marvelous poetry, tremendous myth, opens up the meaning of our own existence. But if you insist that it's also some kind of aboriginal fact, then you lose me, and I can't, in fact, then use it. I can use scripture as wonderful poetry, as good poetry, not as bad science. And I think that it's a mistake to try and I'm not saying that these gentlemen do that, but it is a mistake to insist that the Bible's view of factual scientific reality, which happens no longer to be the going view in our world, we've gone through many, many different scientific revolutions since then. I think it's sad to say that the Bible is actually trying to give us that kind of stuff. I think it's giving us deeper stuff. It's giving us wisdom for our living. I don't think it's giving us science, because the science that it does give us is no longer our science, because we've moved away from it.
Then the question is, how much literalism does one want to vest in the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and where does one want to be literalistic, and where does one want to settle for poetic approximation?
It's interesting, actually, that I don't know any thoughtful Christian who would affirm the great creeds that believes in a three-decker universe.
Yeah,
right. That is taken metaphorically. It's taken as...
By three-decker, we mean earth, heaven, and hell?
Yeah, right. It's just not the way that one thinks about it, other than the fact that this is a metaphor for understanding some things that...
But they didn't take it as a metaphor. I mean, that's the point I'm making.
I'd like to see some way to substantiate that. I think there's no reason to think that the New Testament authors took the three-decker universe seriously.
I think it was the going paradigm. I don't see how they could otherwise have taken it than seriously, because it was the worldview in which they were embedded. It was good science for their time.
No, where do we find any evidence of that? Where do we find any evidence that the New Testament authors were part of a worldview that took literally that there were three levels to it? I don't know of any.
One Peter, the dead Jesus going to preach the souls in hell. I mean, that sounds to me, I mean, I think it's a marvelous metaphor, but it sounds to me as if he actually meant it. But
not as a three-decker universe. It may be that the picture there, even though I don't agree with the picture, it may very well be that the picture is that Jesus in some way communicated with or preached to those who were already lost. But that doesn't mean that he or anyone who thought in terms of that picture thought of a literal three-decker universe.
Now, while you're on the spot, Mark, I'll come back to the other ball that was lofted into the air and take a whack at it. Do you, as I gather you do, and as John Phelan has asserted he does, do you literally believe in the incarnation, that is, Jesus is the assigned Son of God, sent on a very particular mission, and do you believe in the resurrection, as literally conveyed in
I do, and the reason I do is because I think it actually would relate to some degree to some of the things that Robert was saying. I think that if one buys into enlightenment categories of understanding and that particular view of the universe, then the universe is a closed system that cannot be acted on from outside, and the possibility of miracle then drops out. It seems to me that the purpose of Genesis 1 is not to give us some sort of transcript of science. The purpose of Genesis 1 is to say that there is a distinction between creator and creation that is fundamental, and that God, in some sense, made the world from nothing in the way that Christians talk about.
And in the language of the astrophysicists, then, or to borrow their language, God created the Big Bang, or made the Big Bang.
Well, that's just one way of trying to explain it. My point would be that there is as much a buying into a particular set of presuppositions on Richard's and Robert's part as there is with anyone else. And why one should take one set as necessarily being better than another, particularly since I think with most of the scientific issues in physics and so on and so forth, they don't affect Christian faith one way or the other radically.
Well, that leads into a very interesting question. You're all arguing within the context of Christianity. As a non-Christian, I can very well ask, well, now, if you've got some God hunger, as I think people do, that's built in somehow. Lately, we've had some findings, I don't trust them especially, by neuroscience types who think they've found a religion area in the brain. I think that's nonsense based upon a misuse of MRI technology, but be that as it may. Granting there is a general need for a sense of the transcendent and some way of relating to it, why do we have to work within the realm of Christianity rather than, I can offer you the founding religion, the one in which I was reared, Judaism, or I can offer you the various other great faiths of the world. Certainly Buddhism has to be taken quite seriously. Why is this the tradition within which you, the four of you, work rather than some other quite different one? We return to conversation with Richard Holloway, Robert Funk, Mark Talbot, and John Phelan after these words. My question to the distinguished panel here assembled, Richard Holloway, former Bishop of Edinburgh, that is Anglican, or as they say there, Episcopal Bishop, author of the new book, Doubts and Loves, What is Left of Christianity? The answer is very little, except its moral concerns. I think that's the basic answer given in that book. Robert Funk, director of the Westar Institute and founder of its Jesus Seminar, Mark Talbot, professor of philosophy at Wheaton College, John Phelan, president and dean of the North Park Theological Seminary. My question to all four of you, you all share Christianity, is why is that the realm of discourse for those who pursue a need for some contact with the transcendent? Why not Judaism, which is the source, or beyond that, why not Hinduism or Buddhism, which has a very different approach to these questions, but in some ways a rather, in some ways a very interesting one, or for that matter, why not Islam, that other people of the book, or why not the Wiccans, or, you know, 100 other inventive religious movements that one could name, which flourish more or less, at least around bookstores, if not in great temples. Why not one of those other traditions rather than Christianity? Robert Funk.
No reason at all. I only study this because I spent my life learning about it and because I came out of this tradition. But I think we've come to the end of Christendom, and we've come to the, or should have come to the end of Christian arrogance. So I'm not interested in making a large claim that affects everybody else in the world.
Did you start as an ordained minister?
I did.
I thought so. In what denomination?
Disciples of Christ.
Mm-hmm. So you, like Bishop Holloway, have been through a considerable transformation.
Yes, I taught in Methodist theological schools for 20 years. I discovered that what I was teaching my students did not get passed on to their congregations. So I left the theological world and went out into the secular world and organized the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Montana. And after 17 years, I discovered I was not much better at doing that with students, undergraduate students, who learned something in our department, but then went out into the world and couldn't find churches or bookstores to support what they learned at the university.
Same question. I'd love to do a round on that. And so, to John Phelan, why in search for God and a way of connecting to him and in search for the good as God ordains it, why do that in the Christian language and in the Christian tradition rather than one of the other traditions?
I think in the evangelical tradition, we would say that God's Spirit is a pervasive force that is seeking to engage humanity in whatever means possible. And I would never deny that God's is not trying to work his way and his truth in other traditions, and certainly in our brothers and sisters in Judaism from whom we came and to whom we owe so much. I would simply argue as an evangelical that in Jesus we have the person who brings that to a summation and calls us all to faith, but would never deny that God is unable or incapable of working in another tradition. I just think that would be a falsehood.
Bishop Holloway.
Because I was born one, because I was brought up in a Christian tradition, because I think that on the whole, as far as religions go, it's probably as well to stay in one and become as holy and good and kind within it as you can. What I don't think you need to do is indulge in corresponding rejections of others. And I think the saddest thing about Christianity is that it's done that, because it became an absolutist system, taught that there was no salvation outside it, that it was in fact a salvation economy, and it was the great motivating engine behind Christian missionary expansionism, because we had to go around making sure that the whole world became Christian in order to be saved. It was a compassionate motive, if you buy the basic assumption that only in this enclosure are you fished out of the sea of damnation. That, I think, was a kind of imperialism that I think I don't imagine anyone in this room tonight holds in its raw form, but it was the dominant Christian attitude to other faiths until fairly recently, and it's still very strongly held in certain parts of the Christian group.
Do you not find similar proselytizing enthusiasms in other faiths? Surely Islam.
Yeah, I think Islam's got a bit of it, although on the whole it's been more tolerant of the Abrahamic religions than we have, more tolerant of Judaism and Christianity. I think Christianity's had probably the edge on that kind of absolutism. At its most, I'm not saying that every version had it, but it certainly was there. And it accounted, for instance, for the excesses of the Inquisition, that it was far better to torture a person into accepting the true faith in order to save them an eternal life. Better a bit of torture in this life than eternal torture in the other. That's part of our history, and we need to own that, and I think repent of it.
Mark Talbot, why search within Christianity rather than elsewhere?
Well, my reason would tie to the New Testament, which says that faith is a gift, and that faith comes from having heard the preaching of Christ and then having God change one's heart in such a way that it appears credible. So I don't think that it's ultimately something that is based primarily on my weighing what I think of it as much as it is something supernatural. At the same time, it seems to me that there are features of Christian faith, and I take the Jewish faith to be part of the same development. I think that's the way that the Christians looked at it. There are features of Christian faith that obviously are meant to explain more than certain other worldviews, such as Wicca doesn't have as complete a worldview overall. And so there are reasons for thinking that some of the faiths that are more fully articulated are more likely candidates for being adequate as
well. Well, then you've got the ultimate ecumenism in those international or world religions who claim that there's truth in all religions. Baha'i is the most obvious example. We've got a great Baha'i temple somewhat north of here, as you know. What do they delineate? 7 or 8, or is it 9 separate religions, all of which are roads to the truth, and they are all celebrated within that temple and within the Baha'i faith. Is that so ecumenical, so integrative, that in fact it loses meaning?
Well, I think that within Orthodox Christianity, the idea is that God in Christ did something that in fact is necessary for reconciling us with God the Father. And the question then would be whether or not one could connect up with what God did in Christ in the other traditions.
And you are the only one here who has insisted that no man comes to the Father but through the Son.
I don't think I'm probably the only one who would insist on that.
Does John Phelan argue that as well?
No, I thought I had said that earlier. To say that we are part of a tradition that insists on Christ as a way is not to say, I think as you were indicating, that we believe that anyone who's not had a sort of conscious experience with Christ is thereby damned.
Well, we may disagree on exactly how we think that works out.
I think Mark thinks that it's just about the only way.
There's a difference between thinking that Jesus did something distinctive that, in fact, reconciles us with God the Father, and saying that Jesus can only be known by actually hearing the Christian proclamation.
Right.
And different Christians disagree about whether or not you actually have to hear the proclamation. And I think that issue is, in a sense, too deep to get into right now.
There is a social phenomenon that is in the realm of the sociology of religion that must be addressed. And it is, indeed, addressed in Richard Holloway's book. That is, there isn't much evidence of strong, maintained, insistent faith in the Western world. Perhaps there's more in this country. We have statistics that show a great deal of church attendance in the United States, though there's been some follow-up to that. That's based upon self-description by respondents. And when you actually go to the churches they say they go to, you find about half the number of people there that you would otherwise calculate from the respondent data that you collect. That study's been done a few times. But it is certainly a fact that in Europe, the main faiths are in decline by almost any measure, surely by the measure of common church attendance and faithfulness. I take it as meaningful that the Pope had to appoint as the Bishop of Paris a Jew. I'm not quite sure what he was up to with Bishop Lustiger becoming a cardinal, but I think he was up to saying, we've run out of good people. Or maybe he was up to saying, we need to gather others in. That's only a small incident, but in general, one finds a considerable falling away of the clergy in the Catholic Church, and right now we've got a scandal, which lots of us have known about for some time, but it's really hit the papers and hit the level of public outrage and litigation concerning pedophilia within the Church. There's so much that seems to be a touch on the dysfunctional side in organized Christianity, except I will acknowledge from my own knowledge and contact among the evangelicals and the fundamentalists. They seem to, in fact, have enthusiasm, and they're committed to their faith, much more than are, say, the American Episcopalians or various other liberal Protestant denominations. Bishop Holloway, since you developed that theme in your book, I'd love to hear your commentary.
Yes, I mean, in Europe, I think an interesting thing has happened. I mean, I would argue that probably the most important Christian values that Christianity has carried are now implicitly present in the secular liberal democracies. And I think that most people, certainly my children's generation, have rejected much of the kind of social and intellectual underpinning that I think is a leftover from a previous set of ways of understanding the world. I mean, take an obvious example. There is a lot of patriarchal social arranging going on in Scripture, and there couldn't be otherwise because it came out of that particular social arrangement. It had a particular attitude towards women, and that became a crisis for many Christian churches because the tradition clearly stated the subordination of women.
You say, in fact, in the first or second chapter of your book that the beginning of the end of Christianity was the rise of the feminist movement.
Yes, I think that for many young people, not for all, because a lot of people like fairly cut and dried religious systems, and bless them for that, but I think most of the people in Britain, they reached the stage when they were in their faith caught between the challenge of feminism, which they found to be a just ethical challenge, and the response of traditional Christianity, which was locked into a previous way of organizing things, maybe appropriate back then, no longer appropriate now, and they made, to me, the right ethical choice. It was a crisis for me as well, and the effect it had on me was to relativize the authority of Scripture, because I now make choices. I now say, that bit is not appropriate to my condition, that bit is. When you've done that, it's a fateful thing.
Gentlemen, if you'll allow me, I now want to reveal my true colors and my true concerns. Just before we stop for some commercials, and I very much want to get your response to the following, which will be a peroration that will run, may violate my own rule that no single utterance should last for more than 1 minute. In fact, I think the decline of traditional Christianity has ushered in tremendous trouble in the world. If you look at the social order as we observe it, one finds a dozen indices of social pathology which are quite overwhelming. crime is one, general vulgarity in the mass media and in our personal lives, lack of comportment and decency in interpersonal relations is another. The worst of all is the rise of a cult of sensuality, meaningless sensuality, which has quite flooded and overwhelmed young people and confused them, and has brought about a considerable decline in family, in commitment to family, and in readiness to take on the obligations of parenting. I disagree totally with Bishop Holloway that one of the great necessary accommodations in modern life is to bring in and to celebrate homosexuality and the various other modes of polymorphous perversity, which are now being taught and, in fact, are being endorsed in various programs that are being pushed in the public schools, as well as at college levels in gender studies programs. I think we are in great decline and great disorder, and I think there's a correlation between serious religious faith, whatever the faith, and the maintenance of social order. With a decline of serious faith and commitment to organized religion, I think all sorts of devils are let loose. That's a sociological rather than a theological observation. It doesn't, to me, confirm the existence of God or the truth of any particular dogmatic position. But as a sociological observation, I am insisting that there's a clear correlation between social order and the maintenance of serious communitarian or church-based faith with order and with some authority and with moral requirement imposed upon ordinary communicants. And I don't know where in the world we are going as religion dies, if religion is dying. And I'm very interested in your response to that. Was it a 3-minute peroration? after we pause for these words.
At least five.
I find myself, as I think of my outburst of a few minutes ago, in essence agreeing with the thesis of the book, The Decline of the West, or at least predicting that the West is declining. Der Untergang des Abendlandes, and it's declining. It wouldn't go into the same kind of decline, cultural decline, familial decline, but for the absence of strong, organized religious faith. Who agrees with me? Who disagrees with me?
I disagree.
Why do you, sir?
Because I think that you're being kind of romantic and pessimistic. I mean, I think that the human community is always in a state of loss and gain, and I think that there clearly is a loss of a certain amount of discipline, but I think there are gains. I think that order has its successes and so does freedom. I personally prefer the dangers of freedom to the dangers of order, and I think that we've moved from authoritarian moral systems to more consensual moral systems, and that obviously implies a certain breakdown in discipline. I personally would prefer those risks to top-down imposed moralities, because they tend to be the moralities of the people in charge, and they may be tighter on sexuality. They're very often pretty tight on some other fairly ugly things, and I think that Judeo-Christianity has had a kind of downer on sex as such, and I think that a lot of the excesses that you point to are partly a reaction against that. I think that we can, in fact, discover new ways of ordering the human community because it's good for us, and not simply because we're afraid of post-mortem damnation or because we are scared into it. I think, in fact, an effective morality is something that we choose. I think that's the big agenda for us. I think there is a lot of excess.
Would you reject the idea of a knowable absolute good?
Yes, I would. The knowable absolute ideal is clearly a community that lives in some kind of harmony, that doesn't harm, that cares, that protects, that does kindly things towards one another. But I think that there are very different ways of achieving that. And I think that when you get down to particular situations, working those general ideals out is always an inexact science.
But the taking of the lives of unborn children is not an intrinsic violation of any conception of the good.
Well, I don't actually believe that embryos are in fact full human beings. I mean, I respect those who do, but I think that the moral arguments for freedom of choice are ethical. I think that it's a tragic example of the way good people can disagree for good reasons with one another. Mm-hmm. And I prefer moral pluriformity than to the kind of imposed morality that I detected in your passionate and very eloquent outburst. And I think freedom has its costs, worth paying.
I think that there are some false dichotomies there. By the way, I first of all want to honor the bishop for the fact that as he thought his way through the women's issue, that he just decided, I can't take Scripture a particular kind of way, and therefore I'm going to dissent from it. I think that that's honest, and I think that that's important as people try to think about whether or not they're Christians. But it seems to me that we've got a false dichotomy here between what you called consensual morality and what you called authoritarian morality, which you took to be imposed. It seems to me that one can believe in objective moral values and believe in them because one has owned them for oneself, not just because they've been handed down. And of course, one of the questions that we have then is, exactly how does a moral tradition get passed on? And to some degree, that is a nurture issue that does involve parents being willing to correct children in certain ways. My guess is you'd be more than willing to say if you saw a child violating what you took to be the proper standards of respect for another child, that you'd be willing to say, don't do that, and
sure.
Explain why.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I think, in a way, we're ending up with false dichotomies that are too simplistic. The question is, are there objective moral values? And the question is, what is the relationship of religion to those?
I love that formulation. The persisting question, as we pause for a quick update on the evening's news, is, are there objective moral values? And if so, how are they to be known, and how do they connect to religious tradition? We will persist, I trust, on that issue after we pause for the update on the news from Andrea Darler. I do like the simple, strong question I think we have arrived at. Let me just reiterate it as I turn to Robert Funk. Is there an absolute good? Is it knowable? And how does it relate to religious practice?
I really doubt that, I guess, because I think I live in an Einsteinian universe where everything is relative. On the other hand, there does seem to me to be some forms of good that are nearly universal, which we could do well to adopt as our own. But I'm not really very much interested in being a moralist, in trying to impose my views or the views of a particular community on the rest of humanity. Your outburst, by the way, Milt, struck me as a good argument for Islam as a better form of religion than
Why
Christianity.
So?
Well, because it's more regimented.
Mm-hmm.
It's a patriarchal society, and things are much more controlled.
Well, it could be a good argument for Orthodox or even conservative Judaism.
Of course it could be, of course. But I think that was sort of the point that Richard was making, in a way, that the kind of freedom that we have won in the West, in modern democracies, is something we prize above this kind of superimposed moral
system. But are you not aware of a quality, I was asserting it, do you disagree with me, of a certain social disorder and decline in the very texture of American life?
Yes, I do agree with that, but I'm not sure that it owes entirely to the decline of the churches. See, when I go to New Zealand, I learn that the churches there are really very far gone. There's very little of them left. Very few people go to church. But I don't notice that Kiwis complain about the decline of life there the way in which we do in the United States. Now, I can't speak as well about Australia, but I'm wondering, Richard, whether it's also true of England. When I go there, to do the kind of thing I do, I find few people in England and Scotland who are really interested in the Jesus question. And those who are mostly theological students who come from developing countries. There are very few English students or Scots students who are studying theology in the universities of Great Britain.
And I think that culture in Britain is still fairly temperate and on the whole well-behaved. We don't have anything like the levels of crime that you have over here.
You have tremendous increase in crime rates in London, right?
Yeah,
now.
London is a particular case in point. Crime at a certain level, we've never had anything like your homicide rate,
mm-hmm.
and of course we don't have capital punishment either. There may well be something about the American experiment, which is so protean, and new people and new cultures are constantly flooding in. There's always been something tumultuous and excessive about it. It's one of the attractive things about it, but it's always tended towards extremes that I think European cultures haven't. And it's interesting to me that you are a far more religious culture than we are in Europe. Many, many people, and many, many more people are still associated with versions of Christianity. I was intrigued when I read a survey recently that the kind of people who helped the Jews during the Holocaust past were more likely to be non-religious, humanistic atheists than people of passionate religious faith. And I think that there can be a common human decency that doesn't have to receive its mandate from some kind of metaphysic. I think it's almost intrinsic to humanity, which is why you get good people everywhere in and out of religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the problem with that view is that a lot of the morality in Europe and other places is kind of a memory, a leftover gasp of Christian faith and tradition, and that as a matter of fact, morality is sustained within a community. It's sustained within a tradition of people who agree upon and continue to wrestle with that tradition together. And I would expect there would continue to be a dissolution of that and a sort of an individualism that could become more chaotic than sustaining of community.
But don't you think that moral communities do evolve and change, and stability is fundamental? I believe in that, and I believe that you need conservatives as well as radicals, because all traditions need to adapt to new uses. And if you study the history of European and North American morality, it's been enormously adaptive. I mean, the whole integration of women in full equality was greatly challenged, giving women the vote. Our attitude to children has gone through immense changes over the years. Our attitude to slavery, there was nothing very moral about slavery, but scripture justified it. So it seems to me that we're probably all agreeing fundamentally, but I believe that the thing is intrinsically dynamic. It's also intrinsically inexact, but most of us want better societies. Most of us, I think, have an instinct of neighborliness towards one another. But I think that religion makes too many claims to ownership of moral good. It's clearly been one of the main
Well, it would be wonderful if we had a persisting attitude of neighborliness towards one another. That would be the base for a solution of most of the visible social problems that I'm very aware of. But the sense I have is that Hobbes in Leviathan is describing with some accuracy the social condition of modernity, the war of all against all. And though life is no longer short, it has become increasingly nasty and brutish.
Not where I come from.
Well, I spent a lot of my time with very young people, with students at a major American university. And I've been in the university game all of my life. And the sense I have is that young people these days are very much adrift, are rather overwhelmed with confusion, alternating with apathy when it comes to determining what life is about and how they ought to apply themselves. To be sure, at the age of 20 or 21, life is less well formed and organized than by the time you reach 25 or 28 and you choose a profession and begin to get into its narrowing and reinforcing ways. But I see you nodding, Mark Talbot. Why are you?
Well, I'm not quite sure that community alone can do what Richard is suggesting it can do. And it seems to me that if we left community to decide what moral standards are, we don't know where exactly we would end up. My reason for thinking that is that we are right on the cusp of being able to do things genetically and otherwise with human beings that could alter what it means to be human in a remarkable way. And if one doesn't believe that there are some limits beyond which one ought not to go, we could end up with a very, very strange situation. You know some of the books, of course, of creating creatures who are not quite human that can be used as slave labor in factories and so on and so forth. Now, if one doesn't have any objective moral values, it'd be hard to say why we ought not to do that sort of thing.
Well, it depends what you mean by an objective moral value. Most sane people would agree that that would be not a wise thing to do.
On what basis?
I don't think that. On the basis that it's not good for our humanity.
Well, why?
I,
you've got to have some basis from which to say that.
Because you can see the effect that it has. I think that you can actually, you don't need a divine underpinning to recognize that it's wrong to beat someone up or to rape someone. I think that your basic human altruism knows that. I actually happen to think that we created all the moral structures and systems, including the ones mandated by God anyway. So it's talking about something in us. We know, on the whole, we struggle with it, with the tensions that are in our own nature. But I can recognize a good and an evil act without having an external metaphysic to tell me. So
that's ethical intuitionism, of course, by its technical term.
Don't give it any label. I think that it's fairly universal. Most people, on the whole, don't like
the harm.
Well,
I'm not sure
that
it is. In fact, if we go back to what Robert said at the beginning when Milt challenged him about Nietzsche or Jesus, coming out of the Nietzschean perspective is the perspective of Michel Foucault, who, of course, was a famous French philosopher. And toward the end of his life, when he knew he had AIDS, since he felt that all objective moralities were an attempt to keep people under and in one way or another to distort them, he went right on having sex with everyone he could without telling them that he had the AIDS virus because he felt that morality was oppressive. Now, did he have the ethical intuitions that we want him to have? Or in fact, is John right that to some degree, whatever intuitions we have these ways may actually not be so much intuitions as faint memories of a religious tradition that came to us with some authority?
Yeah, but I think its best values are in the system. I mean, I find that in and outside of the church, you find a lot of neighborliness, a lot of compassion, and a lot of confusion. I think these are human conditions, and I think that to claim that religion in some sense has a particular, I mean, it clearly has a historic link with it, but I don't think that necessarily has an enduring mandate to order these things.
The problem is we're talking here anecdotally now, where there's really no way for our to check, for our checking whether or not you're right on that, or whether or not I'd be right if I would claim that evangelical Christianity tends to lead to a greater degree of compassion and neighborliness. So probably that's not a level where we can talk about these things
I'm talking in the human level. I mean, I actually think religion is us anyway. And no matter how you come at your morals, whether you think you're coming through the autonomous, your own autonomous individuality, or whether you think it's coming from some kind of divine conduit, it's us. It's us doing it.
Now, before we pause for some commercials, which we must do shortly, I'd be very interested in hearing both from Richard Holloway and from Robert Funk what the basic message of their two separate books are. I haven't mentioned as often as I should have that Robert Funk, who's got many books to his credit, has a new one titled A Credible Jesus, Fragments of a Vision. What does that title mean?
Well, what interests me about Jesus is not so much Jesus as a person, but the vision he had, or the way in which he saw the world, as revealed in the parables and aphorisms that we think he created. And it's a very unusual, in some respects at least, a very unusual a vision, though I think it is not at all un-Jewish or anti-Jewish. I think it grows right out of the wisdom tradition.
Speaking of Jewish approaches, the Rabbi Hillel was once challenged, to give the full basic meaning of the law while standing on one leg.
Yes.
What's the Christian vision that can be articulated while standing on one leg?
The same one.
Yeah. It's really unfair to ask me that question. I was a Hillel fellow at Vanderbilt University, and I had a rabbi as a teacher.
Uh-huh.
So that perhaps disqualifies me.
But you are saying what remains from Christianity, what can be and should be extracted, is it's the moral precepts that one finds in the preaching of Jesus.
In the preaching of Jesus and Judaism and in other high religious traditions.
And Richard Holloway subtitles his book, Doubts and Loves, What is left of Christianity? What's your answer?
And for me, it is the passionate justice ethic of Jesus. The challenge to power, that power systems always arrogate more to themselves than they deserve and oppress others. A pity for the wretched of the earth, the people crushed by the great pyramids of power. He was a member of that group. And also the enduring challenge of forgiveness. I think that if we could follow that triple ethic, we would transform the creation.
I imagine that John Phelan would say, well, that's fine, but that won't do. That's not sufficient. Am I right?
Well, I would certainly say that what he said is an appropriate thing in terms so far as it goes. And
but you want it to go.
Well, yeah, I would want to say a bit more than that, but still, and I certainly don't want to object to.
What more would you want to say? What would you add as a necessary element of modern faith?
Well, I would want to say that Jesus was more than a teacher of morality. He was more than a teacher of justice. He was certainly that. He was more than a teacher of right and wrong. In fact, he was the human face of God, the way that we engage and discover who and what God is about, through whom we hear and learn of God's grace and forgiveness.
And Mark Talbot, what more would you want to add to what Messrs. Holloway and Funk have settled for?
I would want to say that Jesus is to be understood primarily in terms of his work, and the work was the work of reconciling human beings with God if they would accept in faith what he did.
But to the great question that Francis Schaeffer borrowed, I think, from Aristotle, how then shall we live? Is there any disagreement between the four of you?
Yes. Yes. I would think that I would disagree with the brothers on my left and right on the kind of micromanagement of human relationships. I suspect that I would disagree about the appropriate ways that that humans can relate to one another. I mean, I don't think that the only allowable vehicle for sexual relationships is within marriage, strictly monogamous mm-hmm. marriage. And I know that even that's evolved in evangelical groups because they get divorced as frequently as others, I suspect. So they've already moved away from that. But I would offer the same privileges of discipline, love to gay and lesbian people. And I suspect that's the difference. I would have a much more dialectical attitude towards freedom of choice in the abortion issue. I think that it's a tragic problematic, and I wish that no one, I think, likes abortions, but I do think that sometimes they're ethically allowable, and I think that when you try to outlaw them, you create greater pain. I would rather that we had good sex education so that people didn't, in fact, get pregnant unnecessarily, and very often religious institutions aren't good at helping that happen. And I hope that the morning after pill, as well as good sexual education, might get rid of the horrible abortion holocaust. And I would like that to happen, but I do happen to believe passionately in freedom of choice, and not all Christians do.
I'd like to go back to your sociological paradigm, which you started with, Milt, and suggest some other factors that might well play a role in this. I think one of those...
In the coarsening of America.
In the coarsening of American life. One of the real problems that we have, I think, is the creation of the two-income family for middle-class Americans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Suddenly, both parents are gone all day, so the children do not have proper parenting. I don't know that parents actually elect to do that, but because they want to get on in society, they do. So then the children are pretty much on their own to a much greater extent than I was when I was a child. What about the high mobility of Americans who move all of the time? People move in and out of the community where I reside constantly, so it's very difficult to get any sense of one's neighbor because they're only going to be there for a short time. What about the impact of the media, television, and the movies on our young people? Has that had a good effect on them? Has it taught them high levels of moral behavior, or has it had the opposite effect?
Would not the persistence of a strong, communally shared Christian and or Jewish, and for that matter Islamic faith in this country, tend to minimize those problems? The problem of the two-parent family, the vulgarity of the media, et cetera, et cetera.
We'd have to do a lot more than we've done historically, though. When I was a child, the church was the social center of the little community where I grew up. It ceased to be that almost immediately, or at least after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the churches I've been involved in the meantime are not the social center of the community. There are other centers. There are political and various other things around which people cluster to form their communal life.
Of course, we haven't mentioned it as such, though I think it's been implicit, and I'm about to pause for some commercials and also to invite telephone calls, but this is very visible in Bishop Holloway's book. There is an undoing of standard Western religious sentiment by science. I mean, the great problem for Christianity and for the faiths generally was the rise of science and how that altered human mentality. And I think there are points of apparent irreconcilability which have tended to push many people away from full commitment to traditional religion. And I'll leave that as an unanswered problem because we are overdue for some commercials. But first, I do want to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines right now. The number is 591-7200. Anything you'd like to ask or assert, we're glad to hear from you, but get your call in quickly. 591-7200. 312, the area code if you're calling long distance. And if you're listening on the internet, any place in the world, and would like to communicate, rather than making a call from Sydney, Australia, which we did get the other night, you can, of course, reach us via email. The email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. We return and on to your contributions directly after this. And speaking of our audio archives, which make available many recent programs, which can be heard at your choice and can be heard by anybody around the world, if you just go to our website, the website being WGNradio.com, and then you scroll to extension 720 and you find a number of features, one of them being the audio archive. Speaking, as I say, of the audio archive, tonight's program will be placed upon that archive so that it will be available for you to listen again if you'd like to, or to direct others to listen to it. 591-7200 is our number as we go to the first call, as soon as they tell me what the first call is. And here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
I wanted to relate my comments to something the bishop said about the humanists being the ones, the righteous Gentiles in during the persecution of the Jews. And I have before me a study done by Vad Yashem, Israel's Department of the Righteous, that sought out these righteous Gentiles and find out what motivated them. And among the Christians, it was parents who took religious values seriously, making choices in their business and social lives based on what seemed to be almost absolutes. And whereas the bishop and the other panelists there seem to be very relativistic, and I just don't know if that's how they interpret humanism. I don't know how that they would have stood up against that kind of persecution. Am I making this too complicated?
No, you're not. And I think there's some confusion as to what the real findings are. Bishop Holloway did say that you found lots of people who were essentially secular, who were people who protected potential victims of the Holocaust. And that's true. There were some such. There were also many who were quite religious. There's a particular Huguenot town in France, which was very distinctive in the number of Jewish kids they saved and protected through all those years without turning them into Christians.
Sure. And there were lots of Christian communities that helped ferry Jewish refugees into Britain. No, I mean, it's all anecdotal. I'm not trying to make an absolute point here.
We thank you, sir, for the call. We must range rather quickly. And here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to comment upon a few of the more ethical relativism comments from the English gentleman.
Scottish.
Excuse me, I'm very sorry. I just turned it on.
You just insulted me, sir.
I'm sorry about that.
That's an absolute for him.
this is my first call, so, and I've been listening to the show. Great show, Milt. But, you know, the thing is that it seems like if unless we have an objective moral order in which we cling to, in which we moor such things as human rights and such things as the dignity of, you know, the human person, even if it's more of a secular one, such as categorical imperatives or something like that, if we don't do that, ethical relativism is, you know, the same kind of thing that permits a Nazi Germany. It's the same kind of thing that permits discrimination or eradication of different groups of people. Utilitarianism and those moral positions don't have the mooring that ensures that there's a respect for the human person. And in addition to that, the one individual who made the comment about the ethical intuitivism or something of that nature, somebody's moral code is going to be as good as their, you know, psychological formation from childhood forward. And if you have, a Hutu culture or a Tutsi culture that says it's okay to eradicate, you know, the enemy or the other tribe, what's to stand in the way of that? And just one more little comment, and that is, you may be able to find enormous parallels between, like, the theory of evolution and Aquinas' insights and Aristotle's insights. They've been saying all along that man's a species of animal. And as you look at some of the evolutionary psychology's positions about what underlies a lot of human morality and things like that, maybe the issues of transcendence that Camus discussed in the book The Fall become very important issues.
All right, sir, you've said a great deal, but out of this smorgasbord, gentlemen, what do you choose for your delectation?
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. It was a fairly broad statement. I mean, I'm not opposed to standards. I think standards change in time. I think the basic underlying standard is do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the golden rule, love your neighbor, do not harm, rather do good. But I think that those are so broad. I mean, you're fighting a war at the moment. Presumably you think you're doing good by fighting that war. There's a strong ethical tradition of the just war, but it's highly problematic. Ethics is complex.
Email, and there's a lot of email here. Pope John Paul II, in Veritatis Splendor, in 1992, proposes the witness of martyrs as a proof for objective morality. The argument asks, why would a sane human give up his or her life for a clearly religious belief unless there was a reality greater than life on earth?
Taliban.
Your comments, please.
The Taliban, yeah. That's what they've done. What does that prove?
There have been religious martyrs in every faith, and as a result, it seems as if it would not prove the truth of any one of them.
Then martyrdom may be as much a function of excess and cognitive confusion as exposure to the truth.
Right. It would seem to me that wouldn't be what one would appeal to in order to decide which of the faiths are true.
Mm-hmm. Let me just choose another quick email. I'm curious about the theological answers to the following questions. If the belief and faith in Jesus is the only way, then what happens to the people who died before Jesus? In the 1940s, a whole community of indigenous people were discovered in Papua New Guinea. For sure, they had not heard of Jesus for 1,940 years. How about their people who died in those 1,940 years? These are not meant to be trivial or flippant, but I'm really wondering about these questions from a Christian theological point of view.
Well, again, as I said earlier, because one has not consciously heard of Jesus does not mean that salvation is not available through Jesus. That's always been something that's been part of Orthodox Christian tradition. There's never been an assumption that just because someone existed 2,000 or 5,000 years before Jesus, that there was no way that that person would receive wholeness or salvation. That's, to me, not been a part of Orthodox Christian thought.
Other thoughts?
Well, I don't really have any thoughts on that subject since I think that's not a real issue for us.
It's curious what the Mormons do. They're very concerned about those who were born before Jesus came, and I guess they're baptizing them in those secret rites in the various Mormon temples.
That's right. They get hold of funeral records. Actually, one of the best ways to do genealogical checking up is to do it through
the Mormons.
Mormons.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. Let's catch up with some commercials, and then we will return to the phones, 591-7200, and to the email, extension 720, @tribune.com. And once again, I want to read a very short, which is appropriate, email, and this is directed to Bishop Holloway, or so it says, though I think all four of you might want to respond. Is there anything for you that distinguishes Jesus from other great teachers of social justice, or that distinguishes his crucifixion from the murders of other great teachers like King or Gandhi?
Not really. I mean, I respect those who follow Jesus in a way that allows them to formulate him as some kind of divine figure, that no longer works for me, but I can understand how that particular evolution occurred. I still find him an immensely troubling and challenging figure, whether or not he was literally or actually the Son of God in the sense in which the creeds claim it to be.
It seems to me that within classical Orthodox Christianity, the idea is that Christ's death was different from the time of the Epistle of Dionysius, which was about 150 A.D. The claim was that Jesus, by coming to earth and living a perfectly sinless life and then dying an innocent death, was able to stand in our place in receiving the punishment that we deserved. And the idea then would be that his death, in fact, was meant to be a means of bringing us back, bringing us to reconciliation with the Father. And so the death was quite different than any other death, according to classical Orthodox Christianity.
Well, I find that simply incredible, that God would choose to kill his own son as a way to atone for the sins of the rest of us. I find that just simply implausible.
On what grounds?
In the world in which I live, I do not find it credible. It doesn't work for me. I don't object to those who hold that view. If it works for them, I'm not trying to change their minds about that. Mm. It's just that I had to work this out for myself and my colleagues who are members of the seminar. That's what we've been doing for 18 years.
It doesn't work for you. Does it work for John Thielen?
Well, I think I would object to the notion that God was killing his own son. I don't think that's what the New Testament says. In fact, Paul says that
And, of course, that's not what I said.
No, I know. That's not what you said either.
Right.
God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. The notion that here is an angry God, and here's good and kind Jesus who sort of stands between an angry God and humanity is not a biblical view. And it's a caricature of what actual Christian understanding of the crucifixion is about. And in fact, there are many different ways to look at the atonement and the death of Christ and understand what it is. One of them is to look at the cross as a manifestation of the hideous evil that human beings can do, rather than the kind of atonement theory that was just stated.
Yes, I mean, that's my own way of using the cross. I see it as an archetype of the horrors that we do perpetrate on one another. And it's interesting that it's the one doctrine that the Church never actually completely codified. There is no official, there are metaphors of the atonement, but it was never actually formalized in a doctrinal way, the way the resurrection was, or the way the incarnation was. There are various theories as to how it works, but there's nothing absolutely creedally formed.
Well, it depends what we mean.
Different traditions.
Doesn't it depend, Bishop, about what we mean by creedally formed? The point would be that there is no creedal formulation of it before the time of the Reformation, and after that we've got confessions. Mm-hmm. But the question would be whether or not within the confessional traditions in the West it has been creedally formed is still a live question. In other words, it depends where we say the creeds quit.
Yeah, and it certainly has. I mean, the conservative evangelicals who believe in the substitutionary theory of the atonement, I mean, that's a very, very definite part of their creed. They wouldn't allow me to talk to their students unless I signed a form saying that I accepted that.
But even among evangelicals, that's not the only way to speak about the atonement. It's certainly a prominent one, but there are many other ways. It's like the facets of a diamond, and you go into the New Testament itself, you have many different views and theories of the atonement. And certainly the substitutionary is a part of that, but it's not the only way of looking at it.
And that's already begging the question. I'm not sure that the New Testament, in fact, has that many different views, and that, of course, would be a discussion we couldn't carry out here.
It's just as well, because it's time to go back to the phones. Here's another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, great show, Milt. I wanted to ask your panel a question regarding the Jesus Seminar. From what I understand, I wanted to ask about the methodology of the Jesus Seminar. From what I understand, the Jesus Seminar has a method of voting whether certain portions of the Bible are likely or not, with different grayscales there. And I find it problematic because, from what I understand, the people that vote are really a stacked deck of like-minded individuals. So it seems to be like a self-fulfilling prophecy that they're going to vote it one way or the other. And so a question is this good scholarship, and doesn't this lead towards reconstructionist history and deconstructing a book like the Bible.
Let us just do a quick survey here. Have either Mark Talbot or John Phelan been invited to join the Jesus Seminar?
There's your answer.
No.
Would we join it?
I don't know why you laugh at that. You would certainly be welcome. We've never turned anybody down who asked to join. As a matter of fact, we have not solicited members for a good many years because we've had enough to sit around the table and do what we had hoped to do.
Aren't they like-minded, however?
Well, how do you account then for the fact, look in the back of the five Gospels and see on how many issues there was a unanimous vote.
But there are only four Gospels in the Bible, or in the canon.
But we've been considering actually 23 now that we found another new one.
He means
so there are other
gospels.
Beg your pardon?
I'm
talking about the publication, the five Gospels. You're not aware, apparently, of that publication. But if you look at the votes that are taken, you can see that we disagreed on almost everything. So what does that mean to be like-minded?
Well, what do Dr. Talbot and Dr. Phelan have to say about that?
I think that the methodology is an inappropriate methodology for approaching Scripture, and I don't think that there's much chance of it determining anything objective. And as a result, it seems to me that, in a sense, that sort of attempt to find criteria by which to decide what's true or false in the Gospels is beside the point.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thanks.
We must move rather quickly. I want to read another email to you. A listener says, the Greeks were keenly interested in morals and ethics and their clarification. However, in all the Greek literature that I have read, there was never a reference to their religious origin, obligation, or verification. In fact, their gods were not considered moral examples at all. Morals come from whatever body carries the culture, and it is just an accident of history that it has been the church in our culture for several centuries. It's an interesting observation.
Well, being the philosopher here, all I want to say about that is that what is known in philosophy as the Socratic turn is the point at which Socrates brought moral questions into Greek philosophy completely front and center. And it's interesting that Socrates, in doing that, had a deep religious faith. Granted, it was not the faith of Greek polytheism, and in fact, one of the reasons why he had to drink the hemlock was the fact that he did corrupt the religion of the youth with regard to the traditional religion. But interestingly enough, whenever Socrates gets serious about things with his life and morality, he refers to God and not to the gods.
I mean, if I can come in here, I think there's no doubt at all that certainly primitive religion didn't have much connection with morality at all. It was one of the discoveries of the Axial Age. The 8th century BC prophets discovered that God was a righteous God and that it wasn't enough just to sacrifice burnt offerings. The Old Testament prophets are full of that. And that's known as the discovery of ethical monotheism. So it's not true that there is an intrinsic connection, certainly historically, and I don't think ontologically either. There became a connection, and if you believe in a holy and righteous God, then that's going to have implications for the way you live. But that was a late discovery.
Well, I don't know if it was. It seems to me that that, in fact, involves a particular and, I would say, tendentious view of the reading of religious history. If, in fact, one were to take Scripture as being an accurate record of the development of religion, particularly within the Judeo-Christian faith, then, in fact, we find linkages between God and morality very early.
But I've got an interesting email here. Please, it's two parts. Please introduce everyone again. I'd be glad to. My guest, but that happens. People tune in late sometimes. Richard Holloway, the former Episcopal Bishop of Edinburgh, is the author of many books, the most recent, Doubts and Loves, What is Left of Christianity. Robert Funk is the director of the West Star Institute and is the founder of It's Jesus Seminar. Mark Talbot is professor of philosophy at Wheaton College and is a very active Christian, indeed a Presbyterian layman. Do I have that right?
Well, a Presbyterian by tradition. Right now we're in a non-denominational church.
And John Phelan, Jr. is president and dean of North Park Theological Seminary, and he is ordained in the Evangelical Covenant Church. The second part of this query, and this person has heard other such discussions on this program. I wasn't planning to do this tonight, but she urges me to, quote, also please ask your question about whether you, Paren, Milt Rosenberg, are going to heaven or not. I sometimes do that with evangelicals and fundamentalists. Would you allow the possibility, John Phelan, that I can get to heaven, remaining a more or less secularized Jew?
Well, that's what you call your loaded question. I think, Milt, that is an issue between you and God, and it's an issue that you have to engage God about rather than me to make a decision or make a statement about. I think that would be manifestly unjust or unfair, but I think it is a serious question, and it's one that you need to wrestle with yourself. What is your relationship with God? What do you think about your future and your eternal state? And all those are serious questions, but that's one for you to engage.
I do not think that Jesus is given to me as a vehicle through which I can come to God. I do not accept as in any sense canonical or even true the basic Christological story, though I'm interested in it and I have regard for it, I'm sure. Mark Talbot, would you be more
God's
more severe on
patient.
Me?
Well, in fact, Milt, you and I are friends, and I've got lots of friends who've been on this program. Yeah. And when I mentioned I was coming on tonight, what they said was, that's the one
that
question that makes them think they don't want to come back. And what I would like to say is that
I wasn't planning to ask it.
Yeah, I know you weren't. But it seems to me that to ask that question without having a chance to deal in depth with exactly how Christians think about hell is unfair, because it means that in having to have to give a quick answer, one is going to give an answer that is not likely to be convincing.
I'll offer you something else. Here's another email that came in earlier. This fellow says, Yeshua is the promised Messiah. All Christians are converts to Christianity. Mortimer Adler is now in his presence. It's true that Mortimer Adler, at the age of 97, converted into Catholicism. Earlier, he had converted into the Episcopal Church, in fact. I am mightily offended by the Messianic Christians and by those evangelicals and others who insist that their role in life, if they've got Jewish friends, is to somehow pray for those Jewish friends to be converted to Christianity and to urge upon them various tracts and things which might make them into Christians. I think Jews ought to be left alone by Christians, and Christians ought to be left alone by Jews. And similarly for all the other possible combinations of religions.
I think given what we have done to Jews, we have an enormous arrogance. I mean, Reinhold Niebuhr, one of the things that he said prevented him even thinking of trying to convert a Jew was the enormous scandal, the crux of the Holocaust. And I think it's rooted in theology, it's rooted in this kind of imperialism, the way we even stole your Messiah from you. I don't believe in messiahs. I understand historically that they're the theology of broken people who want to be delivered. Manifestly, the Messiah has not come in that sense. I use messianic language because I do think this is a broken and wounded world that we need to heal. That's the messianic task, not some supernatural intervention from outside.
But if you don't believe in messiahs as such, then my question would be, is the use of the language, in a sense, dishonest and misleading?
I don't think it can. It needs to be. I think that an atheist philosopher like Richard Rorty, for instance, can use the messianic language of the New Testament and the Old Testament just as he can use Marx's eschatology, because he believes in, as we all here would believe, in doing something about the state of the world.
Speaking of Marx, we have to pause to indulge capitalism for a last quick round and then directly back. Time is short, yet miles to go before we sleep, but we only have about 4 minutes left. I want to come back to the very subtitle of Richard Holloway's book. Doubts and Love is the title. The subtitle, What is Left of Christianity? We'll come to Richard Holloway on that in a moment, but what is left of Christianity, John Phelan?
I knew you might ask that question, and I brought around a comment from a New Testament scholar named Dale Allison that I think is a good one. At the end of his book on Jesus, he says, despite everything, for those who have ears to hear, Jesus, the millenarian herald of judgment and salvation, says the only thing's worth saying, for his dream is the only one worth dreaming. If our wounds never heal, if the outrageous spectacle of a history filled with cataclysmic sadness is never undone, is there's nothing more for those who are slaughtered in the death camps or for six-year-olds devoured by cancer. Then let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. If in the end there is no good God to calm the sea of troubles, to raise the dead, and to give good news to the poor, then this is indeed a tale told by an idiot signifying nothing.
Hmm. Well, time being very short, let's quickly go around the table on this. Robert Funk, what is left of Christianity?
Well, we've carried on this debate with Dale Allison about an apocalyptic Jesus, and I no longer believe that to be the case of Jesus of Nazareth. So I don't think he thought that there was something in the future to look forward to in that same sense. I think he was a person who believed in ethics now, in action now, on behalf of those who were oppressed. So I think that's the important thing that's left of Christianity. The way I like to sum it up is that honesty and integrity is the most important thing we have. Care for each other and regard for the planet that is our home.
Mark Talman.
I would, in fact, quote one of Richard's compatriots, Lord Tweedsmer, who said that the faith is an anvil which has worn out many hammers. And my guess is that traditional Orthodox Christianity will be around and vigorous in 100 years when many of the questions we're asking right now will have disappeared.
Is that the Lord Tweedsmer who was also John Buchan?
That's right.
Who wrote 39 Steps.
That's right.
Thing. But he was an amateur theologian as well, I guess. And Richard Holloway, what indeed is left of Christianity?
I can only say what's left of it for me, the way I now hold it. I don't believe that Jesus is an actual Son of God in the metaphysical sense, but I believe that he is an extraordinary figure whose challenge abides, and to that extent he still lives, and he points me towards a very challenging justice ethic of compassion, especially for the wretched of the earth. Life before death for everyone.
Gentlemen, I thank you for what has been an exceptional program. As I said earlier, we will put it up on our audio archive. It'll be there by early next week to be heard into eternity, I suppose, in any place in the world, or as long as the Internet lasts. Our guests have been Richard Holloway, the former Episcopal Bishop of Edinburgh, Robert Funk, director of the West Star Institute and founder of the Jesus Seminar, John Phelan, Jr., president and dean of North Park Theological Seminary, and Mark Talbot, professor of philosophy at Wheaton College. Tomorrow night, a program on food politics and nutrition. Marion Nessel, one of our guests, is the author of a book titled Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Also with us, Dr. Robert Kushner of Northwestern University Medical School. Until tomorrow at 9, a cordial good night to all.